So today we're actually going to be talking about justice, and it is a topic that I'm highly uncomfortable with. I don't really, it's not one of my wheelhouse topics. I get uncomfortable talking about it. It's a hot button issue in our culture. We hear a lot about social justice. We'll talk a little bit about that, but as we get into it, here's really what I want us to understand. So I'm going to say it right up front, and then we're going to look at some scriptures. We're going to support this idea of who God is, some of the character that he has attributes. But when we look at justice, the idea of justice is a lot bigger and deeper than any of the social justice issues we find in our culture today. Justice goes a lot deeper than that. One of the things that we find in our culture as we hit on justice is we like to cry foul. All right. I was talking with some people recently, some people even in this room, and they have a lot more basketball experience than I do. I have next to no basketball experience. Some of you who know me and who have watched me play, and I'm an idiot when it comes to basketball. So this last week, I was watching my son play basketball, and I don't know the rules, and so I think Sarah does get tired of me asking what was that, what just happened and such. But there's certain moments where you can't help but get worked up at any sporting event, whether you know what's going on or not. And as you get worked up with a sporting event, you tend to lash out and cry when you see the injustice of a bad call. And you cry foul, though you may not really know what's going on. But it's interesting, if you just sit there and you watch, you know, fans on both sides will see the injustices that the officials make. And yet, let's be honest, we don't have the authority. Who has got the authority at the time? It's the official that's on the court. He's the one with the authority. So bottom line, this is why I'm saying that. When we look at this topic of injustice today, we got to remember who's the author of injustice. We all naturally will evaluate justice based on our own idea of what justice should look like. But God's got it. And here's the amazing picture. And we're going to see this all the way throughout this morning. We look at a God who loves justice, and we look at a God who loves mercy. How in the world do you fit those two together? And yet he does it so perfectly. So we're going to kind of dig into that. We're going to look at that. I'm going to stay tied to my notes a little bit as we get started because of the uncomfortable nature of my topic. But what we find here as we get started is in Matthew chapter 7, there's an ancient laws based somewhat of the Old Testament, and this is one that Jesus ends up presenting to his disciples and those who are following him. He says, understand this, in everything that you do, you should consider this reality. This is a picture of justice, and he says, so in everything you do, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Isn't that an astounding statement? This is the golden rule. We were taught it in school. I remember in elementary school, the teacher was teaching us the golden rule, and then happenstance, I came across it in Sunday school or something a few weeks later, and I go to my teacher and I said, did you know that's in the Bible? And she said, what are you talking about? I said, the golden rule is in the Bible. And she didn't necessarily believe me, but it was. And so I had to go home and find the reference, and then I couldn't find the reference. And so I have no idea if I ever proved it to her or not. But in a nutshell, this justice picture is scriptural. This idea that we do to others what we would have done to us. And it sums up the law and the prophets. Here's the thing, and I want to say this right now, lest I forget to say it later. We look at justice, and justice is a package that should be served in love. And that's what God does. And yet, when we see the injustices around us, normally we want to serve up justice in anger or resentment or aggravation. And so, keep that in mind as we get started here. So, there's this point in Jesus' life. Oops, he's just crossing the Sea of Galilee. And as he's doing that, he's going away to get some place of solace. And there's all kinds of people that are following him. And as they follow him, they're going along the shores, and he's crossing over the sea with his disciples. And they get to the other side, and look at what happens here. He says, so they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. They're trying to get away. It seems like whenever we try to get away, the phone rings or something like that happens. It feels like, oh, when in the world can I get a break? It's just these constant bombardments of what feels wrong. I deserve to have a break. It's injustices. Some of them are very superficial, don't misunderstand. But many who saw them leaving, they recognized them, and they ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, look at this. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So began teaching them many things. By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples said to him, "This is a remote place, and it's already very late. Send the people away that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." In a nutshell, what's happening here is Jesus is surrounded by poor people. It's an injustice. And when we look at, in our culture, social injustice, usually it boils down to treatment or finances, wealth. And when we cry foul on these social injustices, it's because either people are being mistreated, they're not being treated fairly, or someone has more money than another one. And are they injustices? Probably. But just pay attention as we look through some of these scriptures as how Jesus responds to these things. So Jesus sees the injustice. These people don't have a lot of money. They're poor. But even beyond that, their financial situation, he sees their heart condition. And he looks at them and he says, oh, he has compassion. They're like sheep, and no one is there to take care of them. Only if we could have the eyes of Christ. So he says, send them away. The disciples said to Jesus, send them away so they can get something to eat. And I love Jesus' response. He says, you give them something to eat. And it's like, well, we don't have anything to give them to eat. What do you want us to do? In order for us to buy something, that would take more than half a year's wages. And in our culture, that would be the equivalent of about $17,000 to $25,000 is what it would take. That's about average of half annual salaries, depending how you spin it. That would take more than half a year's wages. And are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? It's like, you want us to take all this money that we have? Notice it didn't say that we don't have the money. They very well may have had enough money to do that. Did they want to spend it all that way? Obviously, the disciples did not. You want us to go spend this? And he said, well, what do you have? Go see how many loaves you have. And so they go and they said, well, we've got 5 loaves. And 2 fish. And then the beauty of what Jesus does is he takes it and he multiplies it, and they ended up having an abundance left over. It's a picture of an injustice that these people are hungry, but yet it's a picture of God's mercy in the midst of it. What we'll see today are injustices happening to the church in the book of Revelation, but yet we will see God's mercy throughout it. I don't want us to miss that. In Romans 3, I remember a number of years ago, I was reading through Romans, and I read chapter 1. Have you read through Romans and just meditate on as you read? Because you read chapter 1, you probably feel pretty good about yourself. Because chapter 1 tends to point to all of the other people that are wrong and unjust. And then you get into chapter 2, and chapter 2 is a little bit of an awakening. It's like, because Paul kind of shifts it and he throws it back into your face. And so you read chapter 1, it's like, yeah, these people are so bad. These enemies of God, they're bad people. And then he switches to chapter 2 and says, you're just no better. And that's kind of the humbling chapter in Romans. And then you get to chapter 3, and what chapter 3 does is it takes both sides and it puts them together and says, all right, just so you guys understand, you're all a mess. And this is what we're looking at here. So we're all a mess. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ. To all who believe, there is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We've heard these verses, but I just want you to understand, when we look at justice, normally what we end up doing is we say, you can't do that, that's wrong. The guy cuts you off on the road, that's an injustice. You can't do that, that's wrong. And so we build up within ourselves a self-righteousness. It's like, you're wrong for what you just did. And we're right for saying that. However, we're just as wrong in other ways. The bottom line of it is, we cry out for justice, and yet we continue to live a life that accepts the own injustices that we create. Do you see that? And yet, look what Jesus does. It's Jesus, who loves righteousness, he loves justice, and he loves mercy. Just get your minds around, how can someone do that? And yet that is the picture that we have. So this righteousness, this fact that we have been owned, the fact that we've been covered, this injustice, and we're going to see this word come up all the time here. He says, all of you have sinned. You fall short. You don't deserve. You're not just people. And all are justified freely by his grace. If we're going to be real honest, we don't deserve justice. You know, if you've been wronged, we get angry. We want to see justice. I remember a number of years ago, someone stole the gas can out of my boat. And that was bad. I was very angry with that. Anytime someone kind of violates your space that way, you can't help but be angry. And it's particularly angry when the boat motors are 1956 and they don't make those anymore. There is no such thing. So you have to go to eBay and find someone who's got one that's selling it. And you pay out the nose for a gas tank that you shouldn't have had to pay in the first place. It's an injustice. So what do you want? He's like, oh, I want to find the guy and make him suffer. That's really what I want. I want him to buy me a new gas tank. I want him to apologize, and then I want him to hook it up. I want all of this stuff because that's what would make it right. That's how I would be then justified. But God does something totally different. We all wrestle with this, like, no, you've wronged me, okay? God does something so totally different. When a mother cares for her children all day long, she serves up a nice supper, only to have them go, ugh, meatloaf again? That's an injustice. And she should take them by the ears and throw them outside in the cold. Right? God doesn't respond that way. I mean, this is this crazy picture where we think we deserve justice, but we don't. The crazy picture of it is like, justice would be us getting what we deserve. But that's not what God does. He gives us this amazing picture of mercy. So look at this. So we deserve nothing. We've sinned and we fall short of the glory of God, but then we are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ. God presented Christ as the sacrifice. In other words, yeah, you have broken my law. You are not justified with me. And guess what? I will pay it. We're going to see that here in a little bit. Through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith, he did this to demonstrate his righteousness because in his forbearance, I like that. There's a phrase that is used in our culture, in our democracy, in our justice system. And it says basically this, it says justice delayed is, does anyone know? Justice denied. You follow that? So by delaying, this is why in our country, why we have the right to a speedy trial. Because if we delay justice, that is an injustice. It's just another one on top of it. And so, but look at this. So what in a nutshell, this is saying, what Paul is writing to us, and he's saying, you guys have all broken God's law. You're all a mess. And if I was going to be justified, I would be totally justified in crushing you. But that's not what he does. Instead, what he does is he flips the coin and he says, in my patience, I'm going to delay my justice and give you grace instead. It's absolutely mind-blowing. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. So where's our room to boast? It's excluded because of what law? The law that requires works? No, because the law that requires faith. I guess what I'm trying to say is, it boils down to this, is sometimes we put ourselves in a very self-righteous position. And when we fall into that self-righteous position, we tend to judge others. And when we're judging others, we seem to think like, okay, this would be the just cause. And what we're going to see then is when Jesus responds, it's totally different. Romans 3, verse 28. For we maintain that a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. Or is God the God of the Jews only? Is he not the God of the Gentiles too? Yes, the Gentiles too. Since there is only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through the same faith, do we then nullify the law by this faith? Not at all. Rather, we uphold the law. And this preceded it, actually. And it gives us a nice picture. What shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? Not at all, for we have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways, and the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Do you know what that describes? I know I'm kind of building this down here, but I just really wanted to paint the picture of who Jesus is and what it is he does. That's us. That's not a picture of anyone else. This is that Romans chapter 3 passage where first it was to the others, and then it came to us, and then he kind of lumped us all together, and this is a picture of us. We are not worthy to be justified. We are not righteous people. But God loves justice. So what do we do with this? He brings mercy. All right. This is it. So that kind of painted the picture of who we are. We line it up. I know this is all preceding where we're going to be at in Revelation, and it's for good reason, because we're going to see these pictures of God's people in that midst, and then to get the final point, it's just going to be dynamite. Not because I did it, because of what he says in the scripture. But Micah 6, this is a picture where we know this. And so this prophecy is to God's people, and this is what God says to them. He says, "My people, what have I done to you that you have treated me so poorly?" Okay, we just saw the picture of us, so this fits with us. That's why we're doing this order here. My people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? What have I done that would cause you to turn on me this way? I brought you up out of Egypt. I redeemed you from the land of slavery. I sent Moses to lead you, also Aaron and Miriam. My people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, plotted. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. And what Balaam, son of Beor, answered. Remember your journey from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? In other words, what can I do, God, that would make you accept me again? What is it that you need me to do to justify myself? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with 1,000 rams? I mean, is that what it would take, Lord, for me to get your approval again if I sacrifice all of this stuff? What would justify it when 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And this is his answer. I've shown you, you mere mortal, I've shown you what is good and what the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Okay, how do we deal with this? And I think that's what we find in Revelation. So Revelation chapter 2, we've been going through the book of Revelation. What in the world was all that other stuff? I want to paint a picture of who we are. When we look at these churches and how these churches in Revelation are struggling, let's be gut level honest, we do the same. And so we shouldn't look at last week in the church of Ephesus and think that we're any better. You know that we have neglected our first love. That's what that Micah 6 passage is really even pointing to. And when we look at Smyrna today and we look at Pergamum today, the cautions that he gives to Pergamum, we're right there. And yet what we will also see is we're involved in a culture that is not that dissimilar from what we see in these two churches. So here we go, Revelation chapter 2. We left off with Ephesus last week. Ephesus had been challenged to be corrected because they had forgotten their first love. They were doing all kinds of good things, but they didn't do it out of love. Remember, justification and justice should be delivered in a package of love. So Revelation chapter 2, verse 8, this is the next church. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, and Smyrna was another port city. They boasted themselves as basically being the most beautiful city in Asia. They believed that they were the largest city, landmass and such, and they just thought, we are the most beautiful. And it was a nice area, most beautiful city in all of Asia. They had the temple for Caesar. So this was the hub of emperor worship, and that'll come into play here in just a moment. So these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. And remember what we talked about last week. At the beginning of each of these letters, there's actually something that points back to who Jesus is that we saw in the first chapter. And then at the end of each letter, there's actually something that points back to the end of the book. And you'll see that especially as we get to the end of the book. When I saw him, this is Revelation chapter 1, okay? This is going off of this here where it says, these are the words of him who was the first and the last who died and came to life again. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. Then he placed his right hand on me and said, don't be afraid. Look at this. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead and now look, I'm alive forever and ever. And I hold the keys to death and Hades. And so the point of it is this again, Jesus keeps saying this every single time. It's like, just so you know who I am and who's talking, I'm Christ. I'm the righteous one. I'm the justified one. So then we get into to verse 9. He says this to the church in Smyrna. He says, I know your afflictions. I know your poverty, yet you are rich. And so here's what was going on in Smyrna. Smyrna, as I said, had the temple for Caesar, so emperor worship. So what that meant was, is those people who lived in Smyrna, all of them, would be required to worship the emperor. They were required to worship Caesar. They would actually have to cry out and say, Caesar is Lord. And if they refused to do that, if they refused to call Caesar their Lord, what would happen is the government would come in, Caesar and his soldiers would come in, and they would take away from them their possessions. They would take their money, they would take this, so they would basically leave them totally poverty stricken. And so Jesus sees these things. These things don't go unnoticed. And so as you struggle, let's be honest, in our culture right now, if you're standing for your faith and you're feeling like people around you, even friends, persecute you because of your faith, because of the stand that you will make, be mindful. God sees it. He says so just right here. God is seeing the injustices that happen to you. He is not blind to your injustices, the real ones, not just the superficial ones. So he says, I know that your afflictions. I know your poverty. I know why you're poor. I know it's because you have not bowed down to worship Caesar. You have not bowed down to worship the king of that region. Instead, you've held true to me. And this is what he says. Though you are in poverty, you are so rich. You know, the interesting thing about justice is we look like, you know, in our culture, oh, they don't have, you know, money. We need to help them out. And that's true, okay? So don't, I'm not diminishing that. But God sees things in such a different light. There's a real beauty here with this church in Smyrna. It's absolutely poverty-stricken. They're relying on God for everything. And he says to them, I know that you're poor, but you are so rich. You have something that these others don't have. You have value in your faith that these others just don't have. And then he goes on and says, I know about the slander of those who say that they are Jews and they are not, but rather they are a synagogue of Satan. And so we see it's an interesting pattern in all of these churches. There's this group that's even within the church, and they're basically deceiving the church. It's obviously a work of Satan. It's the work of the enemy. Their goal is to turn these people away. And so what we had in this sense is there's people that were basically calling themselves Jews, but they weren't Jews. Now, they were fake Jews in a way. That could come in several ways. It could be an actual Jewish person who really isn't holding to any of the Jewish value. It could be a Gentile claiming to be Jew. They may have had outward signs, but the inward work, like what we see coming up here in the next verse, will point otherwise. But looking at this church, before we get into the next, looking at this church, this is what I think drove them. It's this picture of their eternal perspectives affect their earthly priorities. The way that they can look and see what's going to come at the end affects how they act now. Knowing that God says that I'm going to be with him for eternity will allow me to have the strength to say no to Caesar worship now. To be able to say, I will not call Caesar Lord, I will call Lord God, the Lord. That's a significant thing. And so I have to ask ourselves, are our eternal perspectives, are they affecting our priorities? And if so, how? So he says about this, the synagogue of Satan, these Jews, and this is what we find in Romans chapter 2. He says, a person is not a Jew who is one only outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly. The circumcision is a circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not by the written code, such as a person's praise is not from the other people, but from God. So we get back here. I know your afflictions. You're part of the synagogue of Satan. In other words, there's a church that's in among you, and they're not worshiping me. They're worshiping acts, themselves, what have you. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, this is to the church in Smyrna again, I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to the test, to test you. And you will suffer persecution for 10 days. That means not a literal 10 days, it's a period of time. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life. I will give you life as your victor's crown. Interestingly, so Smyrna, this city, it's believed that one of the first pastors of Smyrna was actually a man by the name of Polycarp. He was born in 65 AD. And if you remember when we've talked about Revelation so far, Revelation was written, we believe, in roughly 95 AD, so about 30 years after that fact. So Polycarp would have been about 30 years old at this time. But it's believed that John, the receiver of this vision and the author of Revelation, actually placed Polycarp as the pastor in the church of Smyrna. So literally put him into that position. So Polycarp would have been in Smyrna. He very likely may have been one of the very first recipients of this letter after John has the vision. And he's there. He gets the letter. He reads the letter. He may have been the one that even read it to his people. It's very interesting. We don't know some of these things, but there's a likelihood that could have been the case. Anyway, then we look at Polycarp. He lived, I believe, a long life. I think it was 155, give or take on that, AD, when he died. He would have read these words beforehand. And I'm convinced that he probably was motivated by what he had read here, because this is what it said, and I'll tell you again what it says and then what happened. He says, don't be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you. And you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Polycarp was burned at the stake. So they took him, they tied him up, they built a fire. And as the fire is burning, basically it didn't consume him, so he was still alive. It's just an incredibly long suffering ordeal, trying to get him to say Caesar is Lord, and yet he would not say Caesar is Lord. If I could have the strength of Polycarp. Honestly, what a beautiful picture. It got to be so much that these flames are not consuming him. They actually then impaled him with sticks to finally end the ordeal. It's incredibly graphic and gruesome, but it shows this amazing picture of what these people in Smyrna were willing to endure for the sake of Christ. 1 John 3 says this, the one who does what is sinful is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. And you can see him doing that through people like the lives of Polycarp. It's an amazing thing when we look at the spiritual warfare that's taking place. And that's what was happening in Smyrna. Whoever has ears then, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. One thing to keep in mind, too, and we'll talk about this maybe at the end, the promise that was given to this church back up here, the crown, the victor's crown. You know, we sometimes think that when we get to heaven, we're going to be getting this crown with jewels. There's not really evidence for that, so I hate to burst your bubble, but I don't see that. In fact, I dug quite extensively through the scriptures this last week. Do we get jewels in our crown? There's really no evidence to that. If you can find evidence to it, by all means, show me, because I was unsuccessful in finding it. All right. So I'm kind of, you know, basically deconstructing that, but building up this other picture. And what this picture actually is this crown. And in this culture, what would happen is if you won a race, it's the same language that Paul used in finishing the race and getting that crown. When you finish this race, when you won an event, you were given a crown, and the crown was more like a wreath around your head, like you see in some of the ancient Greek pictures and statues and art. And so really the picture of it is, to those who endure, you'll be seen as the champion because you've endured it, not because you've somehow earned this crown with jewels. Anyhow, So then we're gonna shift into Pergamum, and then we're gonna kind of wrap up everything here, hopefully nice and neatly at the end. So the angel in the church of Pergamum. Pergamum was also one of the cities. Basically, we showed that map initially. You're kind of working in a clockwise formation here. Pergamum was known basically as it had the home of the temple Asclepius, which for most of us, we don't really know or care who Asclepius is. But one of the noteworthy things is she was a goddess who was represented with the serpent. So her temple was there. This was for her worship, and they would worship in this way the snake. They would worship the serpent. And that comes into play here in just a moment. But that's important to note as far as Pergamum goes. So to the angel in the church of Pergamum, write this. These are the words of him who has a sharp double-edged sword. And guess what? We're going back to chapter 1 again. We're going to look at this. In his right hand, he held 7 stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword. Again, here's that picture. Points back to who Jesus actually is. His face was like the shining sun in all of its brilliance. And then he goes on and says, I know where you live. I know where you live. That's scary a little bit sometimes when you consider that. It's like God knows where you live. It's like, oh, just don't look in the bedroom or the closets, okay? I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. Satan, the eternal serpent. What Jesus is saying is, I know the influences that are going on. I'm not blind to it. Yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas. So Antipas was another one like Polycarp, but this would have happened before John had had this vision. And Antipas, it was said, he held true again to the gospel. He held true to his faith in the Lord and would not denounce it. And so what they did is they actually took Antipas and they put him in a bronze pot and they slowly burned, you know, boiled him to death. I mean, just excruciating. This is what the church was suffering. Does that seem just? How can we serve a just God who allows these things to happen? And that's the point, is I think our justice needs to be defined by something bigger than ourselves. So I know where you live, yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, not even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city, the city where Satan lives. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. There are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam. We'll talk about this again. Notice we saw that back in, I think it was the Micah passage, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate the food sacrificed to idols and committed sexual immorality. Likewise, you have also those who hold to the teachings of the Nicolaitans. So basically, here's what's going on in this church. He's comparing it, first of all, to Balaam and Balak. Back in Numbers, this would have been after the Exodus, after God had taken his people out of Egypt, they go out, and as they're wandering in the wilderness, they're coming up to the king of Balak. I believe he was the king of Moab. So King Balak, and he knows the reputation that the Israelites have, and he's like, I can't fight these guys. Their God is too much for me. There's no way I'm going to touch this with soldiers. And so what he does, he knows of this guy named Balaam, who was a prophet, but he was not a godly prophet. He was basically an enchanter. He would say incantations and prophesy in a sense against whatever people would pay him. He was like a prophet for hire, really is what he was. And so Balak, this king, hires Balaam and says, all right, Balaam, guess what? I need you to do a work for me. So this nation of Israel is coming up and they're ready to attack me. And here's what I need you to do. I need you to go and actually curse them so that they won't win against me. And if you know the story, what ends up happening is Balaam is riding on his donkey. And as he's riding his donkey, the donkey keeps trying to turn aside because somehow the donkey is smarter than Balaam, which just says something. Okay. There's a lot of jokes here that would be inappropriate that I won't say. Okay, so he runs him into the side. He stops in front of him. It gets to this point where Balaam will not listen to what God is trying to get his attention to do. And finally, the donkey actually says to Balaam, you're a donkey. You need to wake up and start doing what God has asked you to do. And so Balaam just kind of ignores it. Forget it. And so he goes to actually go ahead and curse Israel because that's what he's being paid to do. And every time he opens his mouth, what happens? He says blessings instead of curses. It's a really great story. So every time Balaam opens his mouth to curse, God sends through a blessing. Every time he opens his mouth to curse, God sends through a blessing. Well, this doesn't really make Balak very happy. Rightly so. I paid you good money, and you just gave blessings instead of curses. So what ends up happening is Balaam and Balak, they basically conspire for a deception. You'll see this word deception all the way through Revelation. The deception in this case is basic. So Balaam suggested to Balak, here's what I think you should do. I think you should get some of your women, and you should go and entice some of the Israelite men so that they will perform sexual immorality with you, and that's your key right there. That's going to help bring down this nation of Israel, and that's exactly what they did. So Balaam, you look at this combination between Balaam and Balak, and when you look at the word Balaam, it's just, there's such vile tongue that goes with it when you read the scriptures. But it was an injustice. And then he says, likewise, you also have those who hold to the teachings of the Nicolaitans. And so basically what's going on here, the picture of it is, it's the Nicolaitans that are acting like Balaam and Balak. Right? So there's not two separate groups. This is one group. He uses the language, he's using Balaam and Balak to express this is what the Nicolaitans are like. They're coming in and they're trying to deceive you into doing things and acting in ways that God does not want you to do. It's like justifying our sin. And that's not what God would ever invite us to do, to justify our sin. So then he says, repent therefore, otherwise I will soon come to you and I will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. I will use my words and I will take them down. Okay. And this is the point where I kind of just want to wrap it up with this. He says, whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who is victorious, I will give some of the hidden manna. Each one of these promises, remember the crown, we talked about that briefly just a little bit ago. Last week we talked about the tree of life and the river that flowed. These are imagery that we see at the end of the book. So I'll give some of the hidden manna. I'll also give that person a white stone with a new name written on it. This is super significant. That's what leads us even in going into this idea of justice right now. Because what this means is, that's why we spent all that time early on painting this picture that we are not a just people. We are broken. Right from Romans chapter 3, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. None of us are righteous. None of us are just people. We can see some injustices. Rarely do we see the injustices in ourselves. It's very easy for us to cry foul when it's on the other team. You know, I've learned this when watching basketball. Basically, this group of fans and this group of fans see the same play and both cry foul against the opposite. It's really something. And I don't like me when I'm watching sports. I've learned that about myself. I don't care for me. I think I would like to be different than I am. And I'm ashamed for sometimes the feelings that I have inside that I don't say outside, but want to say outside. Either way, the point of it is, it points back to me and my self-righteous, like, oh, they were wrong. How can they do that? And like, I should be looking right here. But here's then the point. No matter how unjust we are, no matter how unrighteous we are, this is the picture to those who overcome. And look at this. So what would happen is, in this culture, the white stone was hugely significant because there's only one person who can give the white stone. And that's the judge. And the judge would give a white stone to exonerate the party that's on trial. I mean, this is an incredible picture. And what it's saying then is, I'm giving you a white stone. No matter how messed up you are, I'm giving you a white stone. And then what I like even better is there's something written on that white stone. I'm giving you a new name. And it kind of goes with what I was saying about myself. I don't like me when I'm watching sports. I don't like the fact that it bothers me. And that's something that I look at this and God's saying, he's giving me the white stone and saying, guess what? I'm giving you a new name. In other words, I'm making you new. You're not going to be the same old any longer. I've justified you. It's like, it's impossible. You can't justify me. Yeah, I've got this. I've justified you. So he lays that new stone in my hand. And it's got my new name on it. And what's really kind of cool is the only ones that really know that name are he and I, or me and him. What's proper grammar? Us. Isn't that beautiful? I look at this picture. It's like, I know in our culture we see injustice, and I'm not saying that we ignore those. That's not the point. The point of it is we have an author of justice who also loves mercy. And if we had an author who loved justice and stuck with that, we would all be, ruined. But because we have a God who loves justice and loves mercy, then we get this little white stone with a new name on it because he has exonerated us. And that's an absolutely beautiful picture. Known only to the one who receives it. Oh. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up. I know it's a tough topic, and I don't even know that I did justice to it. That's funny, huh? But the point of it is this. I think as we continue to prepare ourselves to look at the rest of the book of Revelation, this is our moment to continue to reflect. And I think that's why God gave this to John early on, to look at these churches. And so you have to be ready. You have to be ready for, yes, the end to come. But before you can even be ready for the end to come, guess what? You need to take some time, and you need to be ready to be able to even hear the rest of what I have to say. Do you hear that? And I'm convinced that these seven churches really lay out this picture, because each one of the five that are corrected are a call to repentance. I know that I'm not worthy of his justification. I know that I'm not worthy of his righteousness, and yet he has offered it because of his grace and his mercy. I hope you see that today. Take the time to reflect and to pray and to worship as we sing. Lord, what do you have? Remember, I told you we're going to continue to call that repentance for these five weeks. What do you have? What do I need to repent from? What is it? What is it that I need to bring before you and say, Lord, take this?